Hello, and welcome to the How Epidemics End project based at the University of Oxford. My name is Erica Charters, and in these videos, I discuss with experts how they research disease in a variety of ways, as well as their investigations into how epidemics end. Today, I'm here with Christiana Bastos, who's research professor of anthropology at the University of Lisbon. So, Christiana, people might know that anthropologists study humans, human society, and human culture. So how do you study disease as an anthropologist? What kind of evidence do you use in your research?
Hello, Erica. Before we start, I would like to thank you and compliment you and Kristin for this wonderful journey that has been along these months and during most of the period of COVID, to have a team of previously unknown to one another, scholars of health and illness dialoguing with one another around epidemics. I think it was fantastic, and I should compliment you for that. So what do we anthropologists do when we study disease? First thing to be said is there's a classic distinction that we anthropologists say it's 101 medical anthropology. There's one thing that's disease and the other thing that's illness or the experience. So the disease is an entity that is defined in biomedical terms. It's something that is independent of the experience of it. It exists in medical texts, it exists in scientific knowledge, it can be described, you can prescribe things about it. And one other reality, which has an overlapping with that of disease, is the experience of illness. And when you're experiencing some ill health, it may be because you are with the exact thing that is a disease or for other reasons. So there's lay knowledge about this among everyone, in a sense, because one thing is to feel symptoms or malaise or anything, and the other thing is to be diagnosed by scientific methods of something that is independent of your experience. So this is the first thing we know as anthropologists, and we address both things. So there's something that is subject to acts, acknowledgements, all sorts of reporting by people that are under the experience. And there's at the same time an entity of knowledge that defines, maybe not exactly in the terms that the people are experiencing that, but it's identifiable in scientific terms. One thing may overlap very much with the other, but still the two go together, but in different paths. So we address both. We know about, we try to approach with the acknowledgement of what scientists and medical doctors and other health personnel and historians of health say about disease, but we pay a lot of attention to what people are experiencing and relating to that entity. That may sound very abstract, but it is not so abstract when you get to see situations where intense cultural, political, other social determinants influence the way people think about what they're experiencing. And that may even sometimes turn them against getting what would be the prescribed remedies, the prescribed therapeutics for that. Is that clear or is it too abstract?
No, that makes a lot of sense. And I think this distinction between illness and disease, and also thinking about the way in which the experience also shapes our understanding of disease is very helpful and very insightful. And I know you've worked on a range of diseases using this methodology. I know that you right now are working on measles, you've worked on syphilis, but you also started really your research career working on AIDS and HIV. So can you give us some examples of how you researched HIV and AIDS and thinking about what it meant to experience an illness?
Absolutely. I started with AIDS at a very early moment in my academic life. I was a graduate student in New York, and the AIDS epidemic was so overwhelming to anyone who lived there, whether you had AIDS or not, or you knew people. Hardly anyone did not know somebody with AIDS or affected by AIDS in many different ways. And this was before there were effective treatments. There was some. There was a lot of denialism too. There was a lot of fear. There was a lot of community responses too. And we graduate students interested in medical anthropology responded to the crisis also by embracing it as a subject of study and trying to use the methods of research that we used for other things as well. And the one thing that distinguishes anthropology from everything else is what we call ethnography, which is getting a close-up proximity to whatever we are discussing, listening to people, listening in multiple levels, because it's not just about what people say in an articulate interview that matters, but what they say in indirect ways or do not say but are about to say or have hardly formed and shapes behavior, shapes beliefs. And that's always messy and complex. It's not clear. It's not crystal clear like it appears in scientific texts. So it was a earthquake, a chaotic a situation for everyone. And for many of those who were used to be on the side of the healthcare, some things seemed very bizarre, like denialism, more people having mixed behaviors, contradictory behaviors, escaping the logic of what should be the response to a disease. And that's valid not just for AIDS, but for any epidemic outburst. You see in COVID, there's so much denialism that is so bizarre for those of us who are in the side of public health and caretakers and everything. But that emerges from the complexity and the well of contradictions that is human behavior, and that we anthropologists try to grasp a little bit more than when people are using the conventional methods of addressing written documents and linear interviews or statements or everything. So we tend to be more indulgent or more sympathetic or more embrace in a more complicated way, we tend to think of that, the contradictions that are in people's perceptions and actions. So this is one part of it, looking at what is going on ethnographically. So accounting for the contradiction, not trying to follow one truth that's behind that complexity only, but accounting for that diversity and listening to all different messages that come out of behavior and expressions. The way I did it was I had an interest at that time on the making of scientific knowledge. The STS field was emerging kind of at that time. And I was very interested on analyzing how knowledge about AIDS developed, both on the medical side, which was happening, on the, say, laboratory side, which was happening too, on the social sciences side, epidemiology, and on what we, in a very simplistic way, can call lay knowledge, on, you know, people's knowledge that guides and emerges from their own behavior and their own attitudes. So it's something everybody was trying to look at that. There were like all these inquiries on knowledge, attitude, and behavior sort of thing. But it was poor. It was short to capture the complexity that was going on. And ethnography seemed like a good tool, but of course it's slow, takes time, and it doesn't give you immediate answers that are immediately good to transforming public health recommendations. It helps, and many of my colleagues and classmates worked along those lines. What I aimed at that time was a little bit more ambitious. I was a graduate student. It's normal that you are very ambitious theoretically. You want to do something new, or you're supposed to do something new, not just fill in dots of something that is prearranged. So I wanted to look at how scientific knowledge was shaped in different social situations. One thing was what I was seeing around me in New York City, where, you know, all these resources were being pulled together, and there were many different flows and feedbacks, but there was a way of describing it as, you know, the best possible way of people interacting, bringing in all they knew, all the resources they could to trying to find a solution to something that was unexpected in the sense that for many, infectious diseases and epidemics were something of the past. It's not the case for everybody else in the world, outside New York City. And even in New York City, as you end up seeing, epidemics and endemic disease, infectious disease was all over, was part of daily life for many, including many health services. And I could have done that in different places, but the one that I found more interesting to explore what I was looking after was in Brazil. It could have been São Paulo or Rio de Janeiro centers that were equipped with both high-tech research on the biomedical field, with a good tradition of epidemiological research, and also a long familiarity with infectious disease and epidemic diseases. You know, things like Chagas disease was there, leptospirosis was there, malaria was nearby. So there was a range of healthcare providers that were very familiar with infectious disease. Still, that was not the way AIDS first came into being as a clinical entity or as a biomedical entity to be researched. First, it went to DST, to sexually transmitted diseases, along with dermatology, which was the place of syphilis traditionally. But then it went to the infectious disease specialty, which had a lot of experience. So I wanted to see how does that work, the high-tech biomedical research and the long experience with infectious disease that is going on. Maybe I expanded too much on this.
No, I think one of the things that you've written about and that's very fascinating for us to remember now, especially during COVID, is to remember that AIDS was once a new disease. And as you say, thought to be the return of a threatening infectious disease that people weren't expecting. But also, I think what you've written about is this transition in some ways, because we might want to think about, you know, how has AIDS ended? And as you've pointed out, some of it is about the transition to a chronic illness. So like you've just outlined the changes in Brazil when AIDS becomes a different type of disease. So how would you describe the ending of AIDS? Has it ended? What kind of ending is going on with that disease?
Right, you're so right. I'm sorry, I got holds on what had been my research, which was the beginning of AIDS. And it's been a long time. But there is something also very interesting about the Brazilian setting, which was because of the way it was acknowledged publicly, it mobilized a sort of collaborative action. I'm not saying it was a rosy picture of everything, but there was a collaborative action to get solutions that allowed for it to become an issue of public health interest in ways that diverged from what I had seen in the late 80s in the United States, where a lot of denial from the government, from media and so on, was generating a lot of anger by the communities. It's not that it was rosy, but that the creation of a public sphere allowed for it to become endorsed, treated in the public system. So as soon as there were efficient treatments, it became, I wouldn't say normalized, but treated with a sort of attention that was no longer the exceptional different disease. So from here to end, you can't talk about an ending. It's there's a moving from a sort of attention to a different sort of attention by the media, by the special policies, by the energy that is put by society and activists and the public health sector. And once it became acknowledged as a priority by the government, by the federal government, treatments are provided to people with AIDS, it seemed that it was running like a chronic condition, which in a way was the end of the first AIDS, which was a epidemic that erupted, not from nowhere, but not really from anywhere expected. And it challenged and shook all the foundations of what people thought it was their endeavor. For those who were in the more sunny side of life in the world, you know, that meant being rid of infectious diseases and predicted like this. Epidemics was something of less development or developing situations. And for those who were in those circumstances, it seemed to be one more that maybe brought more attention to the world. So maybe it brought in another sort of resources, but again, some problems of creating other sorts of inequalities. So when it became a treatable condition, there was an end to one of the configurations of the epidemic, and it was reconfigured into something else, what was no longer a new epidemic, but a chronic condition that could be treated. And that seemed to be, there was a stability, at least for some. Again, it was very different in different parts of the world. You know, it depends on who you are in society, what sort of resources you have, what gender you have in some places, what access you have to treatment, and so on and so on. AIDS showed that diversity and access to health and the multiple fractures of within global health. What seemed to be a stable situation, which, you know, if you would write about AIDS, say, 4 or 5 years ago, AIDS in Brazil, 4 or 5 years ago, it's like, yeah, it turned into a chronic condition, it gets resources. But something else came along too. So now it's another ending. And it doesn't necessarily mean that it brought better situation to people affected by it. And that was no longer part of my research, but from a student, Rafael, who I supervised in Brazil, he followed how AIDS stopped being treated by infectious disease specialists to be treated by general practitioners in all centers. So that meant another end to the epidemic, but it's not ended. The disease is there, and the experience of the disease is still there for many people. It's like syphilis. Again, you know, it's not that I'm going to talk along on syphilis, but, you know, with penicillin, it kind of ended, transitioned into something else, but it didn't disappear from the face of the earth. Very few diseases disappeared from the face of the earth. Now, the experience of disease, the fear of something that comes with configuration of an epidemic that's appearing from nowhere and is killing and making people suffer and being transmitted from one to another, which is like the experience of a new epidemic, that changes into something else. So it's fading from one thing to another, being experienced in one way at some level, and then in another way in the next phase, and then again in another way in the next phase. So it kind of transforms from one thing to another. It doesn't really end, but it ends as we know it in one sense, gives way to another phase, and that phase can end and go to another phase again.
I think it's a wonderful summary, and I think AIDS gives us such a clear example of this that people will remember, people that we had a different experience, a different response to it at different times. And as you say, there's the medical treatment or biomedical treatments such as medications for other diseases such as vaccines, but how that can change our experience of it. But also, as you point out, it's very different in different places and for different parts of society. And Christiana, your work and especially the method of anthropology, I think really helps us to understand all these different ways that we experience disease. So Christiana, thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us. And thank you also all of you out there for watching these videos. Please do fill out a feedback form. If you're watching on YouTube, the feedback form can be found just below the video. If you're watching on the project website, it's found just to the right. It just takes a few seconds and it helps to inform research at the University of Oxford. Thank you all.
Thank you.